Hello and welcome to Key to IP, the show where intellectual property experts take a deep dive into intangible assets and innovations, discussing recent news and trends from the world of IP. I'm your host, Ruth Skinner, and today we're going to talk about unitary patents and the UPC with two key players from Denner Meyer Group, Dr. Anthony Karlick and James Denner. Good morning to both of you and thank you for joining the podcast. But before we start, where are you both calling in from?
Right, it's Anthony. Hi, thanks, Ruth.
Hi, Anthony.
Hi, I'm sort of a little bit north of Munich, doing home office at the moment, enjoying the lovely, hot, sticky weather that we're getting.
And you, James?
Good morning, Ruth.
Hi.
I am equally based around Munich. I've just moved, so I had been very close to the office until just over 2 weeks ago, and now I've moved to a little town between Augsburg and Munich called Kissing. Which
nice. Oh, that's a nice name.
Exactly. It's a very easy one to to describe to people.
So I'm in Hovald in Luxembourg, sitting in the basement, our basement meeting rooms. So we have a lovely, wonderful sunny day. And we also have Olivia. Olivia's not actually on the podcast, but she's doing the technical support and she's in Romania. So this is very, very global as usual, which I absolutely adore. So Anthony, as both a European patent attorney and a UK chartered patent attorney for Denner Meyer and Associates, you have a great deal of expertise regarding the legal side of innovation, but you know just as much about the inventive side too. Could you tell us more about your scientific research background and why you transitioned to law?
Yes, thanks, Ruth. I'll try and summarise it relatively quickly, otherwise I get stuck all day. So I did a degree in physics, then I wanted to learn a bit more about physics. And I did a PhD in low-temperature quantum mesoscopic devices. So we're talking about low temperature, very, very chilly, 10 millikelvin, so that's a whisker above absolute zero, so minus 273 Celsius. Not much going on. You want that because heat destroys your quantumness. Quantum, we're looking at a quantum mesoscopic device. That's like meso's medium scale. This is medium scale for quantum things, not medium scale for us, like a cat or a dog. It's a very tiny cat. Maybe sort of like half the width of a human hair. And the idea is that you can play about with superpositions of number of electrons sitting on an island. They're sort of like in a superposition of n and n plus one at the same time. And then you poke them and see how many you've got. So it's a bit like opening your Schrodinger's cat box to see if your cat is dead or alive, but merely just tormenting four little electrons on an island. Obviously, that's very specific. And I'm very interested in lots and lots of different things. One of the guys in our lab went for a job interview somewhere and came back saying, oh, I found this interesting job called the patent attorney. So that sounds interesting. Looked into it a bit more. And somehow, I guess 15 years later, here I am.
I can't even get my brain around quantum mesoscopic device. It's a mouthful. For me, it's a mouthful. Mm. I can't even pronounce it. I've never even heard of those little tiny thingies. Very, very small, I suppose.
Yes.
Yes. So also joining us today is James Denner, Business Manager at Denner Meyer Group. James, you bring the market and enterprise perspective to the table. What was your introduction to the world of intangible assets and how do you see the role of IP in business development?
Well, for me, I actually was introduced to the whole idea of IP in the branch I used to work in, which was micro dispensing valves. And of course, very niche product, therefore a lot to protect of these small valves. Electropneumatic piezo technology had not only the valves themselves, which were protected, but also different techniques and processes, dispensing dots in dots, everything possible. But also a lot of the clients, or pretty much all of our clients who were working with the valves, were also working in very innovative fields, research and development, and a very large amount of patents were created from different products and projects which we worked on. So it was a very interesting start. And through happen chance, I then stumbled on the actual world of IP by coming to Denner Meyer. And this is where I discovered even more about it, of course. And the role of IP in business development is a very solid role, especially considering the last couple of years and how certain markets have been restricted. The market of IP has been very stable and if not grew because of a lot of clever people have been very innovative to help us with every kind of possible situation we've been stuck in, whether it was improving the ways of home office or battling the pandemic itself.
Yes. Yeah.
And so the brands, of course, especially in a global aspect, need to be protected. And more importantly, the technology which has been created from it need to be protected as well. So
yes,
very interesting.
Yes, totally agree. It's really interesting to see the background where both of you have come from, and now everyone's sort of like working in the same company and dealing with IP. So it's amazing. So it is advantageous that the long sought after unitary patent and unified patent court are just around the corner for Europe. But if we could start with you, Anthony, what exactly is this new type of patent? What makes it unitary?
Thanks, Liz. That's a good question. Probably we need to clarify the difference between unitary patent and unified patent court. We'll talk about them in two different steps because they're different, but sort of the same. So the unitary patent is a patent that is granted by the EPO with unitary effect. So up until grant, everything happens as usual, as if you'd applied for a European patent at the EPO that we've been doing for years. The advantage of this is that there's no validation effectively needed. Within 1 month of the grant, you just have to request that your patent has a unitary effect, and then it's automatically effective in all the countries that have basically signed up to the unitary patent. So initially, it will cover 17 countries. It's expected to expand to 24 out of the 27 EU states. So it's basically an EU coverage, but Croatia, Poland, and Spain so far have said they don't want to be part of it.
Okay.
So this is in contrast to the situation we have with current European patent applications. When they grant, in order to turn them into a patent, you have to validate them in the one or more of the 38 European contracting states that you actually want it to be valid. So this can mean very high costs. Typically, some countries like Austria, Greece, and Italy will require a whole translation of the whole patent application into the local language, which can be very expensive. So the idea of this is by having one patent with unitary effect, it's cheaper and easier admin because there's only one annuity fee to be paid that covers all your countries.
Okay, right. So it's clear how that will be a welcome option to countless innovators seeking patent protection across Europe. Staying with you, Anthony, how does the new Unified Patent Court, or UPC, fit into the picture?
So the Unified Patent Court will have exclusive jurisdiction for unitary patents. And during the transition period, which I'll talk about a bit later, it will have qualified jurisdiction for qualifying European patents. So the idea behind it is that you have one court to unify and consolidate and simplify procedures. So a judgment given by the Unitary Patent Court would apply to all the countries that are party to the Unitary Patent Court. So for unitary patents, then it's obviously you have to use the Unitary Patent Court, but also those countries that are signatory to the Unitary Patent Court, they're, if you validate your European patent in those countries, UPC can have jurisdiction from that. So I mentioned this transition period. This starts when Germany deposits its instrument of ratification. We're expecting that sometime the end of this year, early 2023. Germany has said that they're not going to do that until basically all the preparations and the court is actually ready to go. Once that happens, the UPC will enter effect, basically on the first day of the fourth month after the deposit.
Okay.
But it's important because once it does come into effect, your patent that is covered by the European Patent Court could be revoked centrally. So there's also an option for patentees to opt out and say, nope, don't want anything to do with it. And then it just remains as individual national rights. So you can avoid central revocation. And you can even opt out during this sunrise period, which is 3 months before it actually starts.
Okay.
And there's a lot more to say about this.
Yes.
There's
a lot of information for us to unpack, but we need to grasp the practicalities for now. James, what impact do you see the UPC having on how companies both in and beyond Europe protect their inventions?
Well, the impact for companies will be very interesting, I think. Anthony touched on it already. The cost factor alone will be very interesting. Reduced administrative work will be very attractive for them. The lack of translations, especially in a majority of countries anyway, would improve this as well. But it just makes the whole thing more practical for the companies. I think there'll be a lot of interest for this. There already has been out talking to different clients recently, and everybody's waiting with bated breath to see how and when they can start.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot for them which they can get from this, especially considering how long-winded sometimes it's been in the past, really, to protect their inventions, especially trying to decide which countries are most tactically clever. And now in one swoop, they'd have everything in one unitary patent in that sense.
Yeah, this level of patent integration is clearly unprecedented. And talking about waiting with a bated breath, do you think there'll be many early adopters, or will companies prefer to take a wait and see approach for the time being?
It's tricky to say. I think the interest is there. And therefore, especially for the larger companies, I believe they're going to really jump on this because it will make their workload significantly less.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe with some of the smaller companies, you may see a bit more waiting just to see if it really is as good as it sounds. Maybe they will still have reduced costs in that sense because they would be looking to just do specific countries and it wouldn't be of significance to cover it everywhere. But it will really be very interesting to see who adopts it and how quickly. I think just from the feedback which I've had from some of our clients already, it is a very interesting thing. And the sooner they can have more information about it, the better.
Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. The eyes of the patenting world will be fixed on Europe in the months and years ahead, very keen to witness the success and lessons of this grand project. But James, you touched on patent filing approaches. Could you both give us some of the pros and cons of various strategies that will be available and tell us how innovators can decide which one is the best for their situation?
Shall I start, James? I don't mind.
I think so. As someone who has a lot more patent experience, I think you're definitely the one to talk about strategy.
Okay, that's fine. So it's interesting. I think the fact that you have this mix of between regional, local, and then central divisions for the court could be interesting because the local divisions will allow parties to bring infringement actions, potentially subsequent invalidity counterclaims, whereas the central division in Paris and Munich, of course, going to be London as well, but Brexit somehow happened and that's not happening, allows you to bring invalidity actions, so revoke centrally, and possibly subsequent infringement counterclaims. And the central divisions can issue a declaration of non-infringement, which is potentially quite useful because that applies to all of the contracting states, the UPC. But this one-for-all approach does mean that you cannot treat it separately for different countries. If you've got a unitary patent, you cannot limit the scope in respect of just one of those countries, nor can you transfer the rights in just one of those countries. It has to be done as a single package. But on the plus side, you can actually license it to some or all of the territories. So you've got a bit more flexibility on the licensing. So I think when it comes to which companies will do which, there will be a mixture of different, many, many different strategies depending on the size of the company and what technology field they're in. Because for some technology fields, such as pharmaceuticals and biotechnology, you would typically have one or two patents that cover, say, a particular drug and is worth a huge amount of money to them. And therefore, you probably want to opt out of the UPC because you wouldn't want to take the risk of this central revocation happening. Because if that happens, then the whole thing dies and you've possibly lost out of your revenue stream from all the different countries you validated in. Whereas if you validate it in individual countries, in order to revoke it, you have to go to each individual country and try and knock it out in each of the countries. Disadvantage of doing that is that you might alert your competitors what the most valuable assets of your portfolio are, because the opt-out will be visible to the general public.
Purely from a company and tactical point of view then, do you think the unitary patent would then make for a more difficult situation when it comes to litigation or maybe people trying to copy or come as close to the patents as possible?
I think it does, again, come back to this question of technology field. I mean, I think for small to medium-sized enterprises, certainly the cost factors and the simplicity of it allows you to get a very large scope of coverage within the countries that you might be interested in and actually potentially assert your rights more easily through the centralized UPC, bring an action in a local court of the UPC. So I think for SMEs, it makes it simpler. I think if you're super big and they have very specific high value patents, then you're probably going to want to opt out. If you're somewhere in the middle, say you're in mechanics and electronics, you might want to have some sort of mixed thing where you opt out a portion of your stronger as well as weaker patents. If you think they're super weak, then you might want to opt them out anyway. Mm. And then fast-moving technology areas like IoT and telecommunications, where there's quite a lot of licensing going on, you might want to take a wait and see, opt everything out, because you can opt back in UPC. But once you opt back in, you can't opt back out again. So you have to think way quite carefully about the opting back in again.
So you can't kind of like change your mind every week?
Yeah, you can change your mind once.
Once, yeah.
And also, if during this transitional period, both the UPC and the national courts would have jurisdiction. So that means that if a court action is brought before a national court, then you're effectively locked into that court and then you can't opt into the UPC.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a way that competitors could potentially like sort of tie you up locally so that you can't take advantage of the UPC to then actually file an infringement action against them for all the broader territory of the UPC, for example,
mm-hmm.
assuming you have a unitary patent.
This is great because I was actually wanted to lead into an open discussion, and the subjects that we were going to talk about was opting in strategy.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so great. It's already done.
Right. Well, we can carry on. There's more points that we can cover actually here.
Yeah, you know, one I have here, which I don't think you brought up, was convenience versus vulnerability of this unitary patent strategy. Do you have any thoughts on that?
For the unitary patent, yes, it is very convenient if you want lots of coverage cheaply and easily. But you have to also bear in mind that certain countries are not covered, such as Switzerland, Spain, UK, Poland, and Turkey, and they're within the top 10 GDP of the wider Euro continent. So you'd still have to validate your EP patent nationally there.
Mm-hmm.
You can also consider like national patents. So it's convenient if it is convenient for you with what you want to do with it. But it does open you up to this vulnerability of this central replication that, yes, you get potentially up to 24 different countries for the cost of four, effectively. But then it is vulnerable that if somebody applies to revoke it and it does get revoked, then it's gone in all those 24. So it's going to be very much what people want to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't forum shop with it because you have to go through the UPC.
Yeah.
Whereas if you validate in lots of different places, you can go, right, I'm going to go for Germany to take advantage of the bifurcated infringement invalidity court system.
Mm-hmm. But what about a mixed strategy like unitary patents and EPs and national patents? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think certainly that would be quite attractive to probably more applicants in the MEC-ELEC field who have large portfolios but typically tend to use them as defensive rights, and maybe they have one or two that they might want to assert. So the ones they might want to assert, they might opt out or apply for a GB, for example, as the priority first filing, because then you've already got that going there in the background, and then you apply for your EP to claim priority from the GB. And then you might go for a unitary patent to cover most of the market and then select some other countries that are not in the UPC and not covered by the unitary patent if, for example, you have a market that's important mm-hmm. to you there. So I think it's going to very much depend on what your market is, what your technology is, and what coverage
yes.
you want.
Yeah. It's clear there's no strategy that is universally good for all patent owners. It's a matter of evaluating the situation of each one on a case-by-case basis. But for the time being, Anthony, what steps should our listeners take to be ready at the beginning of the sunrise period?
So I mentioned that what strategy you take probably depends on what your technology is, your coverage, and your budget, actually. That's a very important one.
Mm-hmm.
So probably want to do some sort of landscape analysis, see where your patent portfolio is sitting, where other people are active, so that you get the right protection for you, because it does need to be tailored to what you're doing. It doesn't want to be sort of, oh, I see competitor X is doing this, I'll do that as well, because mm-hmm. you might have a different portfolio from them. So if you have one patent and it covers, you want many countries and it's high value, you probably want to opt out everything. Whereas if you only have few countries. If you, for example, you wanted France, Germany, and the UK, which is a typical sort of validation selection for ELEC-MEC type inventions, then you might just say, I'm going to validate my EP normally and opt out for Germany and France because they are UPC members. Or you might say, right, I want to keep Germany and France in the UPC because I don't like this bifurcation thing that goes on, and then see what happens in the UK. Secondly, I keep on mentioning this opt-out. On a sort of important legal point, all the proprietors must explicitly agree to opt-out, and the assumption is that the patent owner on the register is the true owner. So there needs to be some housekeeping done here to check who actually owns the patent, because if it turns out that it's owned by Company X Limited rather than Company X LLP or LLC or whatever, and Company X Limited files the opt-out, then it's not a valid opt-out. And if you've got joint owners, then all of them must explicitly agree to opt-out.
Yeah, that's good to know.
So it's sort of, do you want to check it and potentially update the registers in advance if you find there's any discrepancy between who you think the owner is and who the actual legal owner is?
Yes. Wow. Very interesting.
And on that point, another sort of house ownership thing is if you have licensing agreements or ownership agreements, because licensees don't get any say in whether it gets opted out. So you might want to review your agreement with your licensees to see if it says anything about that, or potentially amend it so that it's clear whether it's going to be opted out. If, for example, it's an application now, but it's within a portfolio that somebody licenses from you, then they will want to know, what are the risks associated with just taking a license but not having control over the opt-out?
Mm-hmm.
And will the unitary patent be requested? So it's basically sort of look at who owns what, who's actually licensing it, and you want to update your filing strategy based on your portfolio. Think about it now, as in identify the ones you want to opt out. Which ones do you want for unitary patent, if at all? So there's a lot to think about, and obviously we can help people with that.
Yes, yes. James, anything to add? Or
I'm just thinking about the different mixed strategy elements which we were discussing, and I think this is highly interesting from our perspective as well, purely because not always knowing what to do and simply thinking about cost factors and that administrative element which would be coming into it, this is where it will be very interesting to see how the market reacts in general and what kind of bundles will be offered to simplify this as much as possible for larger clients, which we have.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something where as soon as we know when it will be kicking off and how we can start, that we will be providing as much information as possible to complement the information which we've already provided them with in this podcast to give them a bit of direction.
Yes.
Did want to add a very quick point about this information. Obviously, we've only touched on some of the topics in this,
mm-hmm.
and we do have a white paper available about UP and UPC, which can be found via our website.
Yes.
Which has read more here type thing. So sorry to jump in on that, but you know, just so okay, please.
So our website being www.denemeyer.com.
And this is where you point downwards and say the link is below the podcast link.
So that's just about all we have time for on this episode of Key to IP. Let's bring things to an end with a fun question. Who do you think would be the best and worst celebrity to lead the UPC?
I had some different thoughts about this, and I know we had a brief discussion beforehand. And
yes.
So I most definitely had an idea for the worst, which was Elon Musk, purely because of the chaos he's been bringing. I mean, he's a very innovative gentleman, of course, does a lot of things to help different industries, but at the same time, he's not obviously a man of his word, considering what he's been doing with Twitter now. This might bring slightly more chaotic elements mm-hmm. into it. And working with this in mind, I was thinking celebrities, fictional or not, Chris Evans as Captain America would be brilliant as the best for it, because, and this is where the connect in my head happened, at least, of course, being the leader of the Avengers with Tony Stark being almost similar to a wild card, a Elon Musk-style character. Being able to keep him under control, majority of the time at least, might make him a very good person to be in charge of it, especially for those who know the films. He's one of the only ones who read all the documentation when the Accords were being discussed, so he would probably be well in the know. Yes, sorry, slightly ridiculous, but...
No problem. And you, Anthony?
I have a semi-fictional one. I think probably Alexandre Dumas would probably be quite good, because I'm sure the Three Musketeers would get behind this sort of all-for-one and one-for-all aspect of the unitary patent and the UPC. But Alexandre Dumas is, of course, dead, so it'd probably be quite bad to read it. So unless they adapt the UPC to include an article about necromancy or something, then I suspect that's out.
And it actually fits, as it's the 14th of July today, being the French national holiday, so... Thank you, Anthony and James. This was really great fun, and thanks for taking the time to share your knowledge with us. And for everybody listening, don't forget to check out the go.denamai.com/keytoIP, where you can discover more about today's guests and about our upcoming podcast topics. Join us next time on your industry-trusted IP podcast, Key to IP. Thank you. Thank you, Anthony. Thank you, James. It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.